Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation. It is Monday, April 21st. This morning, the world woke up to news that Pope Francis has died. We revisit an interview with Hawaii scientists about the Pope's letter to the Earth on this eve of Earth Day. We get reaction to President Donald Trump's order to allow commercial fishing in a national marine monument here in the Pacific. Environmental advocates say, see you in court. And did you get enough eggs this Easter weekend? We take a closer look at prices as we check in on what's in your shopping cart. Plus, the Merry Monarch Hula Festival is off and running for its 62nd year. We hear from current and former judges about the evolution of hula. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. A day after Easter and on the eve of Earth Day, Christians and environmentalists are mourning the passing of Pope Francis. The Pope's legacy includes his compassion for the downtrodden and his passion for the environment. He wrote a letter to the Earth calling for better care for our common home. Laudato Si, which translates to Praise Be to You, was written 10 years ago, and a documentary film was produced about the voices he sought to elevate. The young, the poor, the indigenous, and wildlife and biodiversity. Take a listen to part of the trailer for the PBS film, The Letter, A Message for Our Earth.
Well, the Vatican releases Pope Francis's wildly anticipated encyclical on the environment.
La naturaleza grita. Deténganse. Deténganse.
Refugio climático. Un manque de la protection de la nature qui pousse aujourd'hui de nos populations à quitter chez nous.
É perder a terra, a floresta, o grande agronegócio que está chegando aí.
The marine heat waves are causing an unknown amount of death among corals.
I want all the global leaders to do something to stop climate change, because if it's not going to be stopped, it's going to harm our future.
Queridos poetas sociales, porque ustedes son poetas sociales porque tienen la capacidad y el coraje de crear esperanza allí donde solo aparece descarte y exclusión.
Je ne repare si tranquille parfois. J'ai un esprit qui voyage.
O mundo vai mudar. Porque o que estava encoberto hoje está sendo descoberto.
Il faut lisser des liens très fort et il ne faut jamais rompre ce lien.
Che nessuno di noi è un'isola. Abbiamo tutti bisogno gli uni degli altri.
Onde ma? Purhimbe ma da proteggere l'environnement.
Try to be the change you want to see in the world.
We arrive as individuals with very different stories. But we all shared a dream.
Greg Asner and Robin Martin are two conservation scientists who've been working on the Big Island for more than three decades. The couple was selected to be the voice of wildlife in that documentary. Today, we hanahu our conversation with Asner and Martin from 2022. We reflect on Pope Francis's letter to the Earth during a time when U.S. scientists fear their work is under attack due to the policy changes of President Donald Trump in his second term.
Kind of a leap of faith to jump in on this, but he said, we're looking for representatives, someone to represent the voice of wildlife and biodiversity, which turned out to be Robin and me, someone to represent the voice of the poor, the voice of indigenous peoples, and the voice of the youth. And so those are three other individuals. So it ends up being five of us in the movie. Robin and I share the role of voice of wildlife, which was great because we got to do something together.
Wow, but what an honor to be the voices in what looks like a very powerful film.
Yeah, Robin, jump in. I'm not in front of her right now, so she'll have to jump in.
Okay.
The opportunity was something that I personally didn't want to pass up. And then when I talked to Robin, we decided as a couple it would be a great idea, both to do a project together like this and also to represent the issues that humanity is facing with respect to the environment in general, but also biodiversity. And it was great because the movie really put emphasis on Hawaii as kind of an iconic example of the challenges. And so the movie crew, the filming, they came here several times, land, air, and sea. We did a lot of filming. A lot of it didn't make it in the movie, but the experience was amazing. And then, you know, to then go to Rome, join the other voices, that was a whole nother layer of experience in the process.
So when did they first start filming here in the islands?
January 2020.
Before COVID and, yeah.
Oh, just before COVID. Okay. Okay. Well, I've talked with Greg before, you know, about the research projects that you folks are working on with, you know, the satellite mapping and our reefs. But I don't know, Robin, you want to talk about, you know, just the experience, what it was that you felt when you were invited to go to Rome and meet the Pope?
Yeah. Meeting the Pope and having read the Laudato Si, which I hadn't heard of before, but it's an incredible letter to the whole world and all of the people here and humanity in general, and a cry for help, but also hopeful. You'll notice in the movie, we don't give any answers. It's just about the world itself and what's happening here, and with hope that everybody can come together and help the earth heal itself.
The other people that were tapped to represent the voices, was this the first time that you were able to meet them in Rome?
Yeah, we hadn't met anybody prior. And as Greg said, there were multiple different stories originally, and then it settled down onto the five of us. Yeah, meeting them was, and hearing their experiences and stories, just was a really powerful experience.
And Greg, when we last talked with you, you were doing some amazing work, you know, with the mapping to help protect our coral reefs. Where are we at in this whole process?
So my team works closely with the state of Hawaii and federal government and communities to not just understand where the reefs are doing well, where they're doing poorly, but the work that we are doing has evolved to planning and executing interventions that will improve conditions on our reefs throughout the state of Hawaii. And that has a lot to do with coral reef restoration, land-based reformation, trying to get some of the pollution under control that's coming off land. We often talk about climate change, and certainly we've seen some serious climate impacts on our reefs, but our land-based problems are actually turning out to be bigger so far than the climate-driven problems. So really working land to sea, Malcolm Mackay, and working with a range of actors. When you work land to sea, you cannot just be a marine biologist. That's pretty much on the receiving end of the problem. You got to work with land decision making. That tends to be state and county and private land owners and land holders. And so it creates a reef program that is really a collaboration. And then none of that gets done without direct engagement with communities along the coastlines here. So it's a busy, busy space. We're pretty much working 7 days a week trying to make progress. And you ask me what's the status? There are areas where our reefs are doing very well, and there are really big areas where they have continued to decline. And so the challenge is to take the places that are doing well, protect those, and learn from those areas, and then work on restoring the areas that have declined based on the knowledge that we gain from the good areas. So we see it all here in Hawaii, across all eight main islands, and we're trying to use the geography of this incredible place to learn the lessons and then apply them across the entire state.
And have there been challenges with the technology?
Sure. Technology is both challenging, but we also recognize that it's not the solution. The solution really rests in using the technology to inform and to monitor progress. It's really about people. So we're focused in both worlds, but the technology has been challenging, you bet. We're just at the point now where we are routinely, and I use that word carefully, not a research challenge so much anymore, but more of a routine operation, just to understand where are the live corals? How well are they doing? Are there more or less in this area or that area? So the technology has just made those breakthroughs, and that's why we're able to turn towards communities, turn towards the heart of this, which is all of us working together to improve these conditions for corals and coral reefs.
And Robin, you know, the work that you folks have been doing out here for, what, 30, almost 40 years, I mean, when you come across areas where you actually see the loss of the reef as you do your work out there, I mean, you know, what's that been like?
To see the loss is pretty devastating, but to know now that there are pathways to solutions is very hopeful. And as Greg was saying, you know, technology is not going to get us there. It takes the communities. And so that is also our other hat. Aside from being scientists, we have a nonprofit that is positioned precisely to be the interface between science and communities and help communications and help both sides help each other. And so that's been really rewarding.
And can you name, I guess, a few places where you've seen that happen here in Hawaii?
Most recently and extensively in the community of Mililii, they just got their community-based fisheries management area passed, and that was, now it's actually in law, and it's 18.6 miles of the coastline is now under community-based protection and management. It's the first of its kind in Hawaii of such a large extent. That's really going to be something to watch and keep an eye on. And the process is the state believes that it is the first of many that they want to put forward. So that's very exciting.
Greg, anything else you want to add just about the contribution that you think you folks are making, not just to all of us here in the islands here in Hawaii, but really across the globe? I mean, after coming through this experience, you know, I mean, this film is uniting so many people.
Yeah, thanks for the question and the opportunity. You know, when we decided to do this, there were two, you know, conservation scientists entering into a group that all the members come from quite different backgrounds. The poor, the youth, indigenous knowledge, and then this wildlife science that we represent. And people ask us, why did you ultimately do it? And it really has to do with being comfortable enough as scientists to go beyond the question of what and how. You know, as scientists, we often say, what is wrong and how do we fix it? Or we use terms like that. This movie is about the why. Why should we care so much about this? And I don't want to give the whole movie away, but I think the movie really faces the question of why this is so important. And I think when you talk to people about the why, science then doesn't become a barrier. And these other voices are given more of an even playing field with science and sort of the facts and figures of all of this. And it helps people engage, I think, a little more from the heart and the soul and the mind. And, you know, as a scientist, people thought, I think some of my friends thought that we were taking a pretty big risk. And I think it's worth taking the risk, whether you're a scientist or not. So I think that's part of the answer. One other part of it is in Hawaii itself. I've been working in Hawaii on natural resource management, conservation science for, like you said, more than three decades. And this idea that the government is in one posture and the communities are in another and the science community is often in yet a third kind of posture about how and what we should do. The why has got to come first, and then that will get people to work together. And Robin mentioned our nonprofit. That's really about the why. And then we sort of inject the how and what back into it. And I think those are not all the answers, but we're experimenting in on the Big Island, and we're connected across the islands all the way to Kauai. And I think that there's a brighter future if we keep going down this path of breaking these barriers, reducing these silos, and getting people to really work for one another for this future that we all know we want. We don't know how to get there yet, but we know some of it. And so it's going to take more and more and more investment by people in the communities around us to get there.
And Robin, you know, when Greg came home and said, hey, you know, we've been asked to take part in this project, did you feel the incredible pressure, you know, because you were really one of just a handful of voices?
Definitely. Yes. It was not at all taken lightly. And it comes with the sort of hole in your stomach, scared, but also at the same time, just an incredible, incredible invitation to not only meet the Pope, but be a part of a whole movement that is about expressing this message.
I'd just like to say that I'm really proud that we got this chance. Hawaii has a major voice in this movie. both as the icon that it is and the challenges we all face as an island state and island community. And that really, I hope that Hawaii will take a look at this movie. We're speaking globally. We're looking outward in this movie to all peoples, not just Catholics, but all peoples. Pope really, really was careful to make sure that this was outward looking. But Hawaii is front and center, especially from the wildlife and biodiversity and environment portion of the movie. So I hope people take a look at it and get a feel for the message that the Pope is carrying and that the cast carried and that the movie is really trying to portray.
That was Greg Asner and Robin Martin with the Hawaii Marine Education and Research Center. They were featured in the PBS film The Letter, A Message for Our Earth. We spoke with them in 2022. The documentary film with Pope Francis can be streamed at pbs.org. We'll have a link to it on our website later today.
If you've got fresh ideas on how HPR can best serve our islands, apply to join our community advisory board. We're looking for people from all islands. The feedback from our volunteer board helps us shape our programming and events. Apply by May 16th at hawaiipublicradio.org/CAB.
It's spring in the Northern Hemisphere. That means the Dutch flowers are in full bloom.
Flowers that are cut yesterday, brought here during the night, can be in Germany at the end of the afternoon.
And they don't just travel within Europe. Some of those flowers go as far afield as Japan. The global flower trade, next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
News that President Donald Trump signed an executive order allowing commercial fishing within the Pacific Islands Heritage Marine National Monument sent environmental advocates into a tailspin. The monument encompasses nearly 500,000 square miles. It includes Kingman Reef, Howland, Baker, and Jarvis Islands, and Johnson, Wake, and Palmyra Atolls. It was established and protected under President George W. Bush in 2009. President Barack Obama expanded it in 2014. The Conversation's Maddie Bender spoke with Max Phillips late last week. Phillips is the Hawaii and Pacific Islands director and staff attorney at the Center for Biological Diversity. She says the Trump administration's decision to roll back protections for the Marine National Monument threatens 5 species of threatened or endangered sea turtles, 22 species of protected marine mammals, and millions of seabirds.
You know, we didn't have any warning. We woke up yesterday and got the news as it was being signed at the same time that everybody else did. But unfortunately, there has long been pressure from the industrial commercial fishing industry to open up all of our waters to this exploitative practice. And so it wasn't a surprise when you watch the video of the executive order being signed that Kitty Simons, the head of Westpac, was sitting right there.
And how did that land for folks?
You know, it's unfortunate because it just feels like business as usual. And you know, they want to tout it as food security, but this isn't about food security. It's about corporate gain. The commercial fleets pushing for this are not mom and pop fishers. They're not subsistence fishers. They are large industrial operations looking to exploit fragile ecosystems for short-term profits. And if we destroy spawning grounds, there'll be no fish left to catch. You know, opening these waters risks collapsing fish populations that millions across the Pacific depend on for food and income.
There was that study a couple years back showing that these marine protected areas resulted in perhaps spillover effects where fish populations grew outside of those areas. So thinking of them almost as like a nursery or or breeding ground to grow up a sustainable population, but how could that be affected?
Yeah, exactly. You know, scientific consensus is clear. Large-scale marine protected areas work, right? It has clearly demonstrated in peer-reviewed research that these zones enhance fish stocks in surrounding areas through what's called a spillover effect, benefiting even nearby commercial fisheries. And so you don't gut a savings account and expect it to earn interest, right? Like, these protected areas are like our marine bank accounts, and we're robbing future generations of the ecological interest that they would otherwise yield. It's really disturbing.
Talk a little bit about what recourse or any next steps folks in the environmental legal space have.
Yeah, well, you know, Trump's move is illegal. Under the Antiquities Act, presidents can create national monuments, but they cannot revoke or significantly reduce them without congressional action. And we intend to challenge this executive order in court.
Do you think that there are any silver linings to this executive order, or do you see any potential benefit that this could bring about?
No, I just see a poorly thought out illegal plan to pad industry's wallets at the expense of the species and indigenous people of Oceania. Opening the monument to commercial longline exposes these species to increased risk of bycatch, entanglement, habitat loss, and ecological collapse. And this time of global climate change, it's the wrong move at the worst possible time. As the Pacific faces sea level rise, coral bleaching, ocean acidification, we should be strengthening protections, not dismantling them. And, you know, marine monuments like this are part of climate resilience infrastructure. Healthy, biodiverse ecosystems sequester carbon, absorb storm impacts, and help mitigate the effects of the climate crisis on coastal communities. Without them, we're shooting blanks. And additionally, totally disregard for indigenous stewardship and ancestral connections for these waters. You know, they're not just ecologically significant. They hold ancestral, historical, and spiritual meaning for the indigenous people across Oceania. You know, these are not empty spaces. They are storied places and alive with ancestral memory and responsibility. And the Pacific communities have called for stronger protections, not less.
And so the Pacific Islands Heritage Marine National Monument is almost 500 square miles. It trails just behind Papahanaumokuakea. How worried should folks be that relaxing restrictions, fishing restrictions around that could be changed?
Yeah, I mean, very worried. Right? It's just because commercial fishing is currently banned in Papahanaumokuakea, which, you know, like you, I think you said, covers more than 500,000 square miles of oceans. Longline fishing is also banned currently, at least I say 50 miles offshore of Hawaii's main islands. It's clear that this administration is setting dangerous precedent, and I would not be surprised if both our nearshore waters here at home in Hawaii and, you know, further out in Papahanaumokuakea are going to come under direct line of fire from Trump.
And what do you want people living in Hawaii or in the Pacific region to know about some of these decisions, how they might impact their own lives or ways that they could do something?
Well, first of all, it's that we will do everything in our power, legally, politically, and in solidarity with indigenous and frontline communities across Oceania to defend these waters. The ocean has no voice in Washington, D.C., but guess what, Trump? We do. And we will not allow these lifeboats of biodiversity to be sacrificed to the industrial greed of a few. And for those at home listening, you know, your power is in what you spend your money on and what you support. And thinking that, oh, because this is far away, it won't impact me here at home. It will. This is setting very dangerous precedent. And if we don't all stand up and collectively say, a'ole, Trump, you know, I don't know what could be next.
That was Max Phillips of the Center for Biological Diversity. She spoke with HPR's Maddie Bender about President Trump's executive order allowing commercial fishing in the Pacific Islands Heritage Marine National Monument. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. We'll be talking more about eggs later in today's show. Egg prices have soared this year due to the avian flu outbreak. It's not the first time the chicken and the egg have been front and center in Hawaii. The chicken, or moa, has long enjoyed a prominent place in Hawaii. In the days of the kingdom, moa were used as offerings to the gods and as currency for taxes. Their plumage has been fashioned into a hu'ula, and chicken fighting played a role in Hawaiian myths and legends. And the obsession has persisted. In the 1920s, the Honolulu Star Bulletin employed a poultry columnist. Readers regularly submitted questions to the University of Hawaii agronomist for the Chicken Gossip Pigeon News column, which ran for more than a decade. For today's quiz, we want to know what is the scientific and common name for the chickens that the Polynesian voyagers brought to Hawaii. Call 808-941-3689 or toll free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are working to provide affordable housing programs to transition renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NereidHawaii.com.
With more than 60% of Americans taking a prescription drug, there are increasing questions about how these medicines are approved and how they're priced.
We are the only country on earth in which a company can say, because I can, and that's the price, and you got nothing to say about it.
I'm Deborah Becker, Harvard's Dr. Jerry Avorn, on how to fix what he sees as an ailing U.S. medication market. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
Did you do any egg decorating over Easter weekend? How much did you have to pay for that festive supply? Or did you color wooden eggs or even dye potatoes instead? Well, the Hawaii Department of Agriculture recently released its price report for eggs in the Honolulu retail market for the first quarter of the year. One big takeaway, prices are up by 20% for a local dozen and 30% for a dozen eggs from the continent. The Conversation's D.W. Gibson spoke with Matthew Loke, administrator for the State Agricultural Development Division, about egg prices now compared to the beginning of the avian flu outbreak. Loke also spoke about what other commodities we should keep an eye on as tariffs take effect.
Easter and Passover make for that time of year when eggs are particularly popular. How is the supply and pricing this year for those who might have been hoping to score fresh supplies for the holidays? I saw a story about some folks dyeing Easter potatoes instead of eggs because of the price of eggs.
That is correct. We're tracking the price of eggs for April, and it turns out that local eggs right now is priced at 80 cents an egg on average, that is, at the retail level. So that's pretty expensive.
Right. Well, so and where does that put us in terms of the trajectory of the last several months? Because I know we were looking at this issue earlier in the year. Have we been holding steady or heading in the wrong direction in terms of prices going higher?
We were tracking numbers in December of last year. And then since then, we have been seeing a steady increase till April. We have heard that the price of wholesale shelled eggs on the mainland has been declining. But we have not seen much evidence of that yet. I think it does take some time to shift from the wholesale price level to the retail price level. And especially when there's a holiday season around the corner, retailers tend to maintain their price because demand is steady, if not increasing.
Right. Well, you mentioned local production and then eggs from the continent as well. Talk about egg sourcing dynamics here in Hawaii for our listeners. What are we looking at in terms of a breakdown between locally sourced in the islands and imports?
Sure. Domestic imports are basically from California and Arizona. The most important thing we have seen is that the price differential between the local eggs and the mainland eggs have narrowed. In a sense, it means that our local eggs are becoming more competitive. They are able to better compete with mainland eggs on pricing. And I guess one factor that led to this situation is that we now have a bigger producer of eggs on Oahu. So the supply of local eggs has grown over time. And that is good for consumers because as supply increases and demand is constant, prices tend to go down.
Yeah, so that narrowing is in large part, or almost entirely, it sounds like, due to ramping up of local production.
Right. And we are quite excited because in the early 70s, Hawaii was fully self-sufficient in egg production. We have about 240 egg farms across the state. Today in Hawaii, shell egg production is focused on wapi. And I guess for reasons of population size, that makes sense. And I do hope that we can ramp up more egg production on the Big Island, as well as Maui and Kauai. Then we would have a really increase in food self-sufficiency.
Yeah, it's a remarkable piece of history to know. In the 70s there, we had egg production that was sufficient for the islands. Do you have any exact numbers in terms of market share between eggs that are imported domestically and from the islands?
The state population is about 1.4 million people right now. I would say that local production is slightly less than half of the state population. I would think it would be about 600,000 local production.
How does that compare to how many eggs are coming in through domestic imports?
That's a good one. We haven't track that sufficiently, and I wouldn't want to speculate because it does fluctuate quite a lot. And especially right now, when we have this issue of avian influenza on the mainland, it is tricky. Yeah, I think a longer time perspective is better. Like if we take into a 3-year average of eggs being imported into Hawaii, that will give us a more robust estimate. I would definitely like to see that done once we recover from this avian influenza.
Well, I was going to ask about that. So it sounds like that is still very much a real dynamic we're dealing with in terms of egg price points, avian influenza.
Correct. If you follow the history of agricultural commodities, it is always volatile. Agricultural products, as compared to manufactured products, have a lot more price volatility because of changing supply and demand conditions.
Well, I know alternative egg products have become more common, at first for health reasons for those who can't consume dairy, but is there a scenario where some of these products become cheaper than actual eggs and gain a bigger share of the market?
I believe so. Processed eggs is gaining ground. I think it's a good source of value-added production. It's easy to use. And above all, it has a longer shelf life. So there's a lot of potential there. I don't see much of it happening in Hawaii at the moment, but there is certainly a possibility of that happening. We are having a lot more food hubs and so-called food processing centers being built across the state. I would think that that increases the chances of that happening.
Well, and as you alluded to just a moment ago, eggs are a real staple of the shopping cart. How much do you think their pricing helps us understand the bigger picture on staples and common commodities? You know, what can eggs tell us about inflation overall or even the threat of recession or other volatile economic dynamics?
really interesting. There are new terms emerging. There is eggflation, expensive, and it's exciting times that we live in.
We can't resist a little wordplay there, huh?
Well, coming back to your question, eggs are highly versatile. Cooking is easy and little energy is required to cook eggs compared to like barbecue, right? As I mentioned earlier, like most agricultural commodities, the price of eggs is volatile. It fluctuates much more than manufactured goods. And if there is a recession, we would have to make more decisions on substitution to lower priced products within our income constraints, right? Egg is costing 80 cents each, and that's no longer cheap. We did a study a couple of years back on the price premiums enjoyed by shell eggs in Hawaii. So basically, we're trying to piece out the different attributes of a Hawaii egg and what attributes cause it to be priced at a certain price level. And we found that several attributes like organic, local, brown shell, and nutrition benefits influence a higher price on the particular egg. And we were kind of surprised to find out that organic was a much bigger influence than local. Beyond that, we found out that large and extra large eggs have price premiums over medium-sized eggs. So all these attributes, you know, we think about it, could factor into our decision to substitute and enjoy lower prices. For example, if the price of extra large eggs is becoming very costly, then the rational consumer could substitute into medium-sized eggs that will lower the price of their egg budget. Secondly, they could consider buying eggs in larger quantities instead of the standard 12 units carton. Get a 68 carton instead and share it with your friends and neighbors and relatives. That would push the price of costs down. And beyond that, a rational consumer could also mix in some organic and conventional eggs and local and imported eggs to lower the costs. Those are some of the results that we found, and I think those are things that consumers should consider.
Yeah, and I think some of our listeners might even recognize some of those tactics, even in terms of buying the larger cartons and sharing with neighbors and family, a good approach to make when you're talking about 80 cents an egg. I'm not a math wizard, but I believe that works out to about $9.60 for a dozen. And that is a significant price point to consider. Are there other staples or commodities that you think that we should be keeping an eye on, like eggs, that help us understand this volatile economy that we're all trying to navigate?
Yeah, I think that applies to a lot of food products that we consume in Hawaii. We are such a isolated geographic place in the world. Logistics is an important consideration. And with these tariffs that you were talking about, I would pay a lot of attention to fresh bananas and avocados because we import them from other countries, mostly South America. The tariffs may play a big part of it. If we get a 20% tariff from Ecuador, it's probably going to be higher than that. And the price of our imported bananas will go up by at least 20%. And we do import a lot of bananas from Central America, as well as avocados too. We could consider buying more local apple bananas. Actually, local apple bananas to me is better because it's sweeter and it has a longer shelf life. I guess for avocados, it's seasonal. We do have very good local avocados, and that's something to consider as well. Beyond that, we should probably pay some attention to the rice and noodle products from Asia. Close to 100% of our rice products are imported because we hardly produce any rice here in Hawaii, and it's a major staple food. So we probably have to pay attention to that. And for those of us who are able to afford quinoa, that comes from South America as well. And if I have any final thoughts, I would say that a higher price may have a silver lining. If price of food goes up, I'm expecting food waste to be decreased. We do waste a lot of food here in Hawaii. Sometimes it's not our fault. In the case, like, for example, there's a delay in unloading perishable food at the docks, the sun will get to it. But beyond that, when it comes to consumption of food, I think higher price will deter food waste. We'll tend to eat in smaller portions and eat all our food.
No, it's a great point you raise. It's a good opportunity to think about our consumption and to think about our consumption habits and maybe revisit them and make sure we're being
as thoughtful as we can with our consumption and that we're reducing our waste as much as we can. That's a great point. Thank you for making it.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for having me.
That was HPR's E.W. Gibson and Matthew Loke, Administrator of the State's Agricultural Development Division. We do want to hear from you about how egg prices and other kitchen items, how the costs are affecting your lives. D.W. Gibson spoke with a woman named Denise outside a Safeway in Enchanted Lakes and asked her, what's in your cart?
I'm Denise. I live here in Kailua.
What's in your cart today?
Beer and vegetables and some stuff to make scalloped potatoes for dinner tomorrow.
Excellent. Beer and vegetables. You're running the gamut there. I like it, though.
Beer and vegetables. I've got everything else in the freezer at home.
Nice. So have you noticed anything about grocery prices over the last few months?
Definitely ticking up. Definitely. Yeah. Obviously everybody talks about the eggs, but it's not just the eggs. It's everything. And yeah, I'm very fortunate, so it's not that difficult for me, but for other people with big families, it must be getting difficult. You know, you gotta start shopping those deals and going to multiple stores and all kind of crazy things. So it's not a good scene.
Do you have thoughts about the future with all the tariff talk and all that? Do you anticipate the prices might still be going up?
Oh yes, I'm not very hopeful about the next 4.5 years. And so, yep. I think prices will be going up, and I don't know how Donald Trump's going to save face and say that he did it all and everything worked out, but somehow he will do it.
Have you noticed any significant changes at the supermarket? Tell us where to go next. Leave us a voicemail, 808-792-8217, or email us, talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from ESI, Environmental Science International, an engineering and consulting firm specializing in assessment, remediation, and compliance planning. e-science-i.com.
HPR's Live from the Atherton presents two events featuring Hawaii fiction authors. On May 15th, HPR welcomes Megan Kamale Kakimoto and Christiana Kahakawila. On May 22nd, HPR welcomes Kai Gaspar and Brandy Nalani McDougal. Learn more at hprtickets.org. Sponsored by HMSA.
Support for HPR comes from Haleakala Ranch with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to restore, maintain, and preserve the open vistas and natural beauty of Maui. More at haleakalaranch.com.
And now it's time to come clucking for the answer to today's backyard quiz. We've been learning about chickens, our feathered, sometimes feral friends. Scientists believe feral chicken populations peaked in Kauai after Hurricane Eva and Aniki destroyed chicken coops across the island. Feral chickens began mating with the escaped ones, and the number of wild birds skyrocketed. But chickens have long roamed Hawaii. They were the only bird brought to the islands by the Polynesians and play a role in Hawaiian mythology. The story of Lepe'amoa, the chicken girl of Palama, tells of a girl with supernatural powers who transforms herself into a chicken to win a fight. For today's quiz, we asked you for the scientific and common name for the chickens that Polynesian voyagers first brought to the islands. And we were looking for Gallus gallus, the red jungle fowl. But we stumped you on that one. No winners today. That's our quiz. If you have an idea for one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. The The 62nd Merry Monarch Festival kicked off Sunday with the Ho'olalea. The prestigious hula festival competition will be held later this week. Here with the preview is HPR's Cassie Ordonio. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I can't believe it's here already.
I know, and we are seeing a lot of fierce competition going into this week-long Merry Monarch Festival. And what I'm also noticing is there's this kind of growing debate and conversation about contemporary hula being woven into traditional hula. I know it's been kind of growing, and some may consider it controversial. I know that's 20 Halal will be performing at this year's competition, including the Academy of Hawaiian Arts by Mark Keili'i Ho'omalu, who is known to be pushing the boundaries of hula. And they're going to be performing in two major categories. So there's hula kahiko, which is the ancient traditional dance style of hula. And they're also going to be performing in another category called hula awana, which is the modern dance of hula. And each halau gets 7 minutes to perform in those categories. I spoke to Malia Lobenstein-Carter, who is a current judge and the former Miss Aloha Hula. She participated as a dancer in 1975 and came back in 1982. But she noticed this kind of growing contemporary dance of hula in the 1990s and 2000s. But although generations before her would say it's been earlier, she said that the shift of modern hula into traditional hula or ancient hula is considered controversial to some people.
The controversy comes when you start to take traditional chant and mele and looking in the hula kahiko, especially because the hula awana is its own animal per se to tackle. So in the hula kahiko, when you have traditional chants and mele, we all in Hawaii, and even now that our ohana have extended to the continental US and globally, is that we recognize that there are traditions, there are foundations that run the same for all of us. You know, it's just like with anything, we all come from the same tree. We're just all different branches, and no branch is better than the other. No one is higher than the other. We're just different. We're unique. The low, the leaves that sprout from these branches are what make those branches unique. That's the way to look at it, as hula as one tree. So there should be an underlying similarity in the things that we present as traditional hula. Now, is there room for creativity? Yes, there is, but it needs to still feel, look, sound, move like hula.
And I brought up earlier Kumuhula Mark Keili'i Ho'omalu of the Academy of Hawaiian Arts. He's always been open about pushing that boundary of hula. You look at last year's hula competition, his halau were wearing these multicolored green skirts, and they were using papahe'e, which is this wooden plaque that hula dancers were stepping on. It created this bass effect. And once they were doing it while chanting, the crowd was just going wild for it. He's definitely a crowd favorite. And even, I think, 2016 or 2018, he had another performance with his halau that kind of stirred up a little bit of controversy. Some people loved that performance, and people didn't like it. But it's because it was a fire dance for King Kalakaua in 2016 or 2018. And they had their skirts rolled up, the women, their skirts were rolled up, and it kind of looked like they were wearing a malo. So some people were kind of questioning his choice of dance. But for him, he wants to kind of think outside the box when it comes to dancing hula.
The difference between what I do and what the so-called, quote-unquote, traditionalists, or who they want to call traditional, do, is they're not contemporizing anything. They're stuck in a groove, trying to bring things from the old days and make it relevant to today, that no one finds appreciation in it. When people don't appreciate it, they get upset. But that's normal. You're outdated. I mean, how many people do you know right now that have a rotary phone? Everybody's got a phone, but no one has those old ones. It's outdated. Unless you're a historian in that sense and you like old, rustic things, no one appreciates it. No one has time for that. Times have changed, and I don't think I'm contemporary. I'm a 1970s Renaissance hula dancer taught by a 1970s Renaissance Kumu'ula, and I carry on that idea of it. And what has happened today is, today we have these big movement on being traditional, and basically it's taking everything that we've learned and putting it in reverse.
He is very straightforward. Mm-hmm. A little bit of his Oakland side is really leaking into that interview, and I'm here for it, actually.
Yeah, no, very innovative. Yeah, it's fun.
But it's not just Markele Uho'omalu. The late Kumuhula Johnny Lamho was also considered controversial, but a lot of people appreciated his creativity. You look at, I believe it was Giola Pula, who is a Miss Aloha Hula back in 1983. Melia also considered him controversial.
He wrote things of his childhood memories of, you know, growing up. And with Uncle Johnny, it's people either loved him or hated him, what he did. But whether you liked the performances or not, you had to appreciate his creativity and his commitment to sticking to his guns. He never did it to win, ever. He did it because that was the tradition he was going to uphold. So the minute he started his pa'i, you could close your eyes and know that Uncle Johnny's girls were on the stage. If I didn't see who was chanting and I just saw the dancers enter the stage, I would be able to tell you that's Uncle Johnny, just in the way that he carried and presented himself. And he was considered controversial. Like from my grandmother loved him as a person. Sometimes she would tell him, oh, John, like, I don't know about that presentation. But she always mahaloed him for his creativity because he continued to use the language. He continued to create, you know, and this is where there's a fine line, right? If we don't create new mele, we become stagnant as a culture. So then the question comes, okay, when can we infuse modernisms into our hula?
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see what they come up with this year.
Exactly. So it's a wait and see for this year's competition.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Cassie.
Thanks for having me.
I was HPR's Cassie Ordonia. Look for her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Well, that does it for us today. Tomorrow, the Western Pacific Fisheries Council kicks off a series of meetings with fishermen across the state. We hope to hear more about President Donald Trump's executive order to allow commercial fishing in the Pacific Marine Monument. Got some feedback for us? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. You can find the conversation on our website or as a podcast on Spotify, Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the conversation.